So we're in the third Sunday of, in Advent, and we're doing a series based on the Advent candles. And Randy has chosen to do sermons from taking these topics from wisdom literature and applying them to the topic of the candles. And this week we are looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. And this book has always given me the sweats. I don't know about you, but they were, for many years, they were some of the whitest pages in my Bible that I never, there were no fingerprints, no underlinings, no, and to be honest, so when I was in seminary, they give you a pile of books to read, and my Greek professor would say, your eye has to hit every word. So there's a difference. I realized he was giving me an out. Because there's a difference between your eye hitting every word and actually reading, right? So Ecclesiastes, I'm sure my eyes had hit every word at some point, but I didn't really read it. And when I did, it makes me nervous. I feel a little on edge. And another thing, I don't know why I'm bringing up seminary so much, but what another professor told me one day that really helped me, and maybe it'll help you, is that when you get to the hard parts of the Bible, he said, you should rejoice. He said, because that is proof that the Bible, that's one of the proofs that the Bible is true. Because if people were making this stuff up, they would leave out a lot of things that are in your Bible, right? There's a lot of stuff in Genesis that I would have scrubbed immediately if I was trying to start a new religion or build something from the ground up. Ecclesiastes would not be in this book. You know, if I was trying to create my own religion, I would want things to be, I would want simple answers. I would want things to make sense. I would want sins to be hidden. I would want, you know, to be pretty. And the Bible, although it is pretty and beautiful in a lot of ways, it can be a hard book to understand. But when I come to places like this that make me feel sweaty, I actually take a little deep sigh of relief, thinking, "Okay, Lord, this is the truth. You know, I don't know how to understand it. I need your help to help me understand it." But it reminds me that this isn't a game. God came into the real world to deal with real life problems. And his word is very profitable for that, even in the parts that you've been avoiding your whole life, like the minor prophets and Ecclesiastes and Lamentations and things like that. So I don't know how much experience you have with Ecclesiastes. I actually have a fair amount. I preached through this probably 10 years ago when I was pastoring in Ashboro. And I texted a guy that was at that church at the time when I got here this morning, because I remember that every Sunday as we go through it, he'd be like, "Can you please move on to something else?" So I texted him this morning. I said, "I don't know how your life is going, but at least you're not sitting through an Ecclesiastes sermon this morning." So you might be feeling the same. You might be feeling that you're getting the short end of the stick today. We'll find out. So Ecclesiastes, wisdom literature. Wisdom literature is to provide you simple truths, generic truths about life that you can apply. You can apply today to your actual circumstances. But wisdom literature can be tough. They speak in broad generalities a lot of times that they state as obvious facts, like train your children the way they go up, and when they're old, they will not depart from it. How many of you have found that to be questionable? Right? They're generic truths. In most cases, this will happen. Ecclesiastes has a lot of similar circumstances where Solomon is going to make very broad brushstroke statements that can make you sweat. And they should. But I want them to make you sweat for the right reasons, not just because they're hard to hear, but because they're going to give you some really deep truths about life, I hope, from today. Solomon was stated to be the author of Ecclesiastes. And I don't know if you know much about Israel's history during that time, but as Israel was small, very powerless, surrounded by giant, surrounded by strong neighbors, surrounded by other nations that could beat up on them. They were always at risk of being invaded. When Solomon took over, the boundaries of Israel expanded quite a bit. He got involved in international trade. He was the wisest man who'd ever lived. He knew how to guide the country for a while. Israel was growing and growing and growing. It was a lot like America in a lot of ways. A lot of promise. Things felt like they were there. Anything could happen. You know, the American dream. This book speaks very clearly to the American dream. And in the book, Solomon is gonna go through a series of experiments where he's trying to find what life is really about, where meaning really comes from. And I'm gonna read you just a little bit of what his answer was. And remember, this is coming from a guy that had all the money, all the power, all the resources to pull off the things that you and I spend our lives wishing we could do. I want to be impactful. I want to be wealthy. I want to be good looking. I want to do great projects. All those kind of things. Solomon had unlimited resources, unlimited labor to build whatever he wanted to build. And this is from Ecclesiastes 1. Through the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does a man gain by his toil, at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south, goes around to the north, and around goes the wind. And on its circuits the wind returns. All the streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, they flow again. And all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, the ear with hearing. What has been will be, and what has been done, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. That kind of gives you a little flavor of Solomon's tone as he goes, of the man who set himself to find the meaning of life, comes up with a word that gets repeated 38 times in the book. And it's called, in Hebrew, if you have the NIV, I think it's vanity or meaningless. What does your text say? Is it vanity? Meaningless, vanity. The word is hevel, and it means smoke. And a little Tim fun fact I found this week. Abel, his name in Hebrew is, guess what? Hevel. He was kind of temporary in the story, in the Bible, wasn't he? It's like, I don't know, when you came out this morning to get in your car, as you're walking out to your car and breathing, you know, that you see the puff of smoke that comes out of your, and it's there 1 minute, and it's gone the next. Solomon is saying, nothing lasts. Everything falls apart. Just like my 53-year-old body. That time, death and time devour us all and undo everything we've worked to build. Whether you're rich or poor, a failure or success, death and time will erase you. And soon enough, you'll be remembered no more on the earth. You know, I own my own business, and I spend a lot of time thinking about success and failure. And how do I become a success? I'll be happy if my business is successful. Because my business has taken a big hit this last couple years. And I've spent a lot of time pondering the meaning of life and success and realizing that living for success, it's not always cracked up to be. Even when I've achieved success, I realize I'm just not happy no matter what. Well, if I have success, I'm not satisfied because I could be doing something more. If I don't have success, I'm stressed because how am I going to pay my bills? It undoes itself. Living for fame, not something I struggle with so much, but I remember, well, that's not true, I'm lying. I'd love to be famous, I guess. Let's be honest. But I have a funny story about fame and what you get from it. You know, you think about what would I get if I was super famous? Maybe the pinnacle would be something named after me or a statue. And I went to school at UNCG, and is the McKeever statue still out there? In front of the library was this big, tall statue of a guy named McKeever. Charles? I don't know. He was famous, probably. Did a lot of things. His statue, though, the best you can do is get a statue where no one's going to remember who you are. Pigeons are going to poop on. And I remember one day I was walking to class, and someone had put a pair of tidy whities over his face. And I thought, that's what I'm hoping for. I mean, that's the pinnacle. If I can reach success, I might become a statue that college students will deface and do that kind of thing to. You know, living for pleasure. You know, living for the weekend, taking vacations. I want to travel the world. But you know, Monday always comes. Havel, Havel, Havel. I hope I'm saying that right. Which leads me to today's topic, joy.
Nice segue.
All that was the introduction. You know, how do we live this life under the sun? A lot of people argue with Ecclesiastes, and I read some commentaries where people are trying to make sense of this book. What do you do with this book? You know, this is not the book that really you feel like belongs in the Bible. And what some scholars will argue that this book is really just an attack at those who don't believe in God. An attack on them, and in this life under the sun that Solomon talks about means a life, you know, when you don't think there's a heaven, it's just under the sun. I really take issue with that. You don't need a whole book of the Bible, you know, to beat on unbelievers to show them that life without God is invaluable. I think this book was probably written maybe to Rehoboam, his son, to kind of guide, unfortunately did not work, to guide this guy in the way of wisdom, to guide us, God's people, in the way of wisdom, that this life under the sun is what we're all experiencing, it's what everyone under the sun experiences. How do we deal with the fact that everything is vanity, it's smoke, it doesn't last? I'm going to read you a poem from Ecclesiastes 3. And I goofed up and only put 11 verses in your bulletin, so thankfully Michael fixed it, and it'll be on the screen maybe. Ecclesiastes 3, 1 to 14. And this will sound familiar to you. And at the surface, it'll sound very encouraging. Unlike most of, but I'll deflate that in a minute. In chapter 3, Solomon writes, "For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn, a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What what gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the business that God has given the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for man to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, and also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil. This is God's gift to men. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken away from it. God has done it so his people will fear him." This is God's word. So in 1965, a band called The Birds. Anybody know this song? You know this song? Okay. I'm going to have Ellie come up and sing that now. Will you? No? I'm not singing it. But it was taken from Ecclesiastes 3. You know, it's so hard to do it without singing, though, to say the lines. You know, there's a time for... Okay. I'm going to read you this, the last line, anyway. The Vietnam War was raging, and the song's most poignant, and we'll see most unbiblical line, it says, "There's a time for peace. I swear it's not too late." So what are they saying in there? What have you heard about this poem? What I grew up hearing was kind of what, maybe I got it from The Birds, I don't know, that there's a time for, I mean, if someone was struggling, they would say, there's a time for everything. You know, I know you're struggling now, but there'll be a time that comes when you won't be struggling. That everything is perfect in its timing. You know, you can, it's, everything's going to work out okay. You know, I think The Birds missed the point. Solomon isn't really saying that there's a time for everything, and that that we can pursue peace now. That now is the time we should pursue peace, not war, Vietnam. It's a good notion in the 60s, I guess, but it's hardly what Solomon is trying to get across. If you want to go back and see, he says this. He is the one who laid out the course of events in all creation. The Koheleth, which his name is the teacher, regards God as the absolute authority and arbitrary master of destiny. See, in the Old Testament, a lot of times, well, we do this too. When you say, in heaven and in earth, what are you really saying? Everything. Right? That when the Bible gives you opposites, it's really saying this extreme, and everything in between. Right? Obviously. I mean, you get that, right? This poem is saying that everything under the sun, there's a time for everything, whether from every extreme, and that in this pairing of human events, it indicates what the guy's going after is the universality of God's control over time. He is the absolute determiner of everything that happens. He is the one who picks whether it's a time for war or a time for peace, a time to tear up or a time to plant. He is the one that is setting that. This is not just a pie in the sky saying, oh, things are going to work out okay. They're saying that Yahweh is the one who sets all of it, all of the time. God is in absolute control of the events of history. And that's not just Ecclesiastes talking. There's a quote from B.B. Warfield, who was in the early 1920s, was considered one of the smartest men alive. And he said this. He's talking about the Old Testament, the way they deal with this idea. And he says, "All things, without exception indeed, are disposed by him. And his will is the ultimate account of all that occurs. Heaven and earth and all that is in them are the instruments through which he works his ends. Nature, nations, and the fortunes of individuals alike present in all their changes the transcript of his purpose. The winds are his messengers, the flaming fire his servant, the natural occurrence his act, prosperity his gift, and calamity falls upon man. It is the Lord who has done it." And you see Amos 3. "It is he that leads the feet of men, with they wither it or not." I like that line. "He raises up and casts down. He opens and hardens the heart." He opens and hardens the heart and the very thoughts and intentions of the soul. Well, that sounds pretty good. I'm on board with that. God is in control of everything. And what is more, he goes on in verse 11 to say, he has put eternity into our hearts. Now, what does that mean? He's put in your heart. There's no true atheists in the world, according to the Bible. He has put eternity. You know there's a God. You know that you can tell he's there. But then it goes on to say, he has purposely blocked us from seeing his plan. I don't know if you caught that. Let me go back to verse 12. I perceive that whatever, verse 14, whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it or taken from it. Oh, wait, no, I skipped it, sorry. Verse 11. He has put eternity into man's heart, yet so he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. In Hebrew, it actually means he's put like a veil down in front of our faces. He's put eternity in our hearts. We know he's there. We know there's a God. And yet he's put a veil down so that we can't see what's happening in these times. You don't know what time it is. I don't know what time it is. I think I know what time it is. It's time to suffer. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. He knows. He sets the time, yet he's blocked us from seeing it. Why on earth would he do such a thing? Solomon answers the question in verse 14. He said, God does it so men will fear him. As you've seen from Randy's preaching through Proverbs, fearing God means casting all of your trust on him, throwing all of your confidence on him. He has blocked us from seeing. He's very clear. He has a plan. He's in control. He's not going to tell you what it is. It's why? So that you will trust him. God has purposely laid out all the events of history, including yours and mine, and he lets us see some of the details, but not the whole picture. God has done this in a way to keep our priorities straight. We were meant to love and enjoy God, not to be the captains of our own destiny. God in his mercy is helping us focus on that upon which we were made to see. And I wrote this line for myself more than anybody else. But spending our days forecasting the future is a sure way to ruin your life and enjoy none of it. And what do I do all day long? I got to play a game while I was sitting out here, and I'll have you try to join me in the game a little later on. Just while we're here in the service this morning, as we're singing these songs, do you think I was thinking about the words of those songs? I wish I was. I wanted to. I kept trying to, but I'm worried about, what am I going to say when I get up here? Am I going to look really stupid? Is anybody going to hear what I have to say? Oh, about just churning, forecasting. Is this going to be a good sermon or a bad sermon? You know, what am I going to have for lunch today? My mind is just constantly looking ahead, trying to figure, why? I want to avoid pain. I want to get pleasure. I want to know what's coming so I can be ready for it, right? My mind can't stop it. I'm going to bet yours is the same way. I'm constantly forecasting. Why would he do that? And what's his answer to that? Well, I guess that's the big question. What's Solomon's answer to this? That life is vanity. Life is short-lived. Things fall apart. Everything falls apart. God has set the time and he's blocked us from seeing it. So where's the joy in all that? Solomon, I didn't read the how he ends chapter 2, but I'm going to read you the verse right before that, because he is it called an inclusio when you put something in the middle? I don't know my Latin or my music. He has a point he's going to say at the beginning and at the end of this passage that kind of says to you, okay, this is why I'm telling you this stuff. So he ends chapter 2 with this. He says, a man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too I see is from the hand of God, for without him, who can find enjoyment? And I don't know if you caught it, but in the verses we just read, he says this, I perceive there is nothing better for them to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil. This is God's gift to man. So this time poem is sandwiched between these two ideas. This idea of eating and drinking and finding satisfaction in your toil actually appears more than 6 different times in the book. Solomon keeps coming back to this. Obviously, it's one of his main points. And let me just read. I'm just going to blow through these real quick just so you can hear what he's trying to tell you from Ecclesiastes. And then we'll talk a little bit more about it quickly. He says, a person can... Well, I already read 2 and 3, didn't I? In chapter 5, he says, this is what I observed to be good. And it's appropriate for a person to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God has given them, for this is their lot. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and to be happy in their toil, this is a gift of God. They seldom reflect on the days of their life because God keeps them occupied with gladness of heart. And 8, he says, so I commend the enjoyment of life because there is nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany them and fill their them in their toil and all the days of their life God has given them under the sun. And then in chapter 9, go, eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. Always be clothed in white and anoint your head with oil. Enjoy the life with your wife, with whom you love, all the meaningless days, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun. And that's the vanity word, not necessarily meaningless, this vaporous life. And all your vaporous days, for this is your lot in life and your toilsome labor under the sun. So, fearing God, casting everything, just like the rest of wisdom literature, is encouraging you, cast your cares on him, cast your trust on him, has something to do with a man should eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. So what on earth could Solomon be getting at here? Fearing the Lord, trusting him, eat, drink, enjoy the toil in your vaporous days on the earth. I think his main point is that the key to joy, or a key, is realizing your life is hevel. It is passing away. Things are going to fall apart. Things are unsure. So let me ask you a question. How much time do you spend trying to control the uncontrollable? Most of my life, I think. I do. When I come to adopt a posture of trusting God, it opens up the possibility that I might be able to enjoy my life by focusing on what is in front of me right now and not fixating so much on what I think ought to be or fear what things might turn into. A buddy texted me the other day, called me and asked me, how's my joy? This is before I wrote this sermon. But you know what I started doing? I started listing all the things that were going wrong in my life. Sure sign that I'm doing this wrong, that I'm not casting my fears on the Lord, and I'm looking to my circumstances, the vaporless circumstances to prove whether I'm happy or not. And I was busted right there. I caught it and thought, oh, again. Joy is not to be found in circumstances. You know that. I know you know that, right? But in trusting God moment by moment, joy comes to me today, trusting him to set things straight in his own time and to enjoy the gifts he's given me today, to live trusting him despite the fact that I'm going to remain puzzled by most of life's mysteries. Joy comes from a moment by moment, minute by minute, casting your trust upon God and trusting him for the final results. Ecclesiastes ends with these words. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every good deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. When the judge comes, he's going to set things right. And for us, for Christians, that's a good day. That's going to be a great day. When I look at the vapor of my life and all the things I've tried to build that have fallen apart, all the people I've tried to love that have ended up leaving or stabbing me in the back or running away, I mull over those things. And I find myself very unjoyful. And what I think Solomon is getting at here, just before we talk about this judgment, is that That's an empty treasure. It's a dead end road for you to be going down to be forecasting what's going to be happening. How am I supposed to deal with what might be coming down the future? Solomon doesn't say don't plan for the future at all. In the book, he actually talks about doing international trade. Who knows what God will do to live your life? But knowing the fact that it's vaporous, knowing the fact that the things I put my hand to the plow to could just go up in smoke. So how do I live with joy in that? Well, he says in here, he's saying, if you're in a restaurant and you get a good meal, enjoy it. If you're in a circumstance where something good is happening, let it steep in your heart. Think about what's happening right this moment. Trust him in this moment, not for what is in the past, because what's in the past is gone. What's in the future is out of your control. Now, that's so easy to say. But this is what we practice. This is what we need to be practicing. And what we know is that when the judge comes, see, what Solomon didn't know is that when Jesus came and was born in a food trough, he took on Hevel at its most powerful. He was poor. He was broken. He was abandoned by his friends. He suffered more than any human in history. He immersed himself in Hevel. And and even to the extreme, to death, the biggest stealer of them all, and turned it on its head. And that Jesus says he's making all things new, a kingdom whose foundations are solid and eternal. Jesus solidified the smoke. He promised that all things must do his bidding and work for his glory and our salvation. We live now knowing that the king is on his throne and working. And Ecclesiastes reminds me that God is coming to judge all things. He's coming to set things right. That's what Judgment Day is. So all the things that have gone up in smoke in my life, all the things that I feel like have been a waste, he's going to bring this to a good end. Just how he's going to do that, I have no idea. He's blocked my eyes from seeing it, just like everybody else's. But joy is found in the letting go of my needing to control and resting in the sovereignty of the one who is in control. Have you ever heard the term mindfulness? It's a word that's come to, in my life in the last couple of years, has come into, I've been hearing it and learning about it a whole lot. And really, all the whole idea is this, is that to pay close attention to what's happening right now. That's being mindful. It's the opposite of what I was doing as I was sitting out there pretending to sing songs, mouthing the words to songs. Being mindful is focusing intently on the current moment. And what I think is really what Solomon is kind of getting after here is to say, the thing, when he's talking about food and drink and toil and your wife and all this kind of stuff, he's saying, pay attention to what God has put in your on your plate right now. Now, and to enjoy what you have. Think about right now. Think about where we are right now. Like this exact moment. We're sitting in a room filled with people we love. We know that we're worshiping a God who is taking care of us. We have this beautiful building that's been provided. It's the beautiful decorations. There's so many things that I can enjoy right this moment and not be worried about whether checking my app to see if I've made enough sales today. See, one of those robs my joy. One of them gives the opportunity to sit here with people I love and care about, go to the Mexican restaurant after church and actually savor the food. Enjoy. That's what he's calling you to, because he says, I'm in control of all of it. I'm in control of what's going to happen to you tomorrow. I'm in control of what's going to happen at the end of your life. And I also know now, Jesus has come and he's whipped the devil. He's taken the Hevel out of things. It may appear like everything in my life is falling apart, but I know he's going to work it out somehow. But he has blocked me from seeing it. I need to own that. And stop fretting about it so much. And just say, Lord, it's in your hands. Help me to trust you right now with what you have. And I know a lot of you are sitting there going, well, I don't want what I have right now. I get it. But there are some things that are good right now. Just like just being in this room. Right? There are some beautiful things you have, even if your life is blowing up. My wife has been the best illustration of that to me. And that's the physical hardship she's going through, her attitude has been, she has thrown her trust on Jesus' feet. And I told her on the way over this morning, she should be preaching this sermon, not me. I mean, I know all that's easier said than done, but that's what Ecclesiastes, amongst other things, but is really about. Is reminding you who is really at work, who is really going to decide whether your business makes it or not, your friendships make it or not. Everything is all, but is in his control, and you can trust him because he came and was born in a manger, suffered his whole life, was a man of sorrows, died on a cross, but rose again and owned it, and is in control of, is transformed even death into something beautiful. That we wear a stinking, you wear a cross around your neck. You know what that is? That's an instrument of torture. That's like an electric chair around your neck. Like if you were goth and wore all that. But what has he done? He's turned something that horrible into something beautiful. And if he's done that, maybe he could do that with your story too. Solomon would have you cast your cares on the feet of Jesus, who's in control of all things. And when things turn sour, remember that he died for you. He's in control of this world and is coming back to make everything sad untrue. Amen.